My name is Justin Rundy. I'm going to be conducting the interview today. I'll be asking the majority of the questions. My name is spelled J-U-S-T-I-N-R-U-N-D-E. Good. So I'm going to ask you the first question. What is your name and can you spell it for us?
I'm Grace Chalier. Last name is C-H-A-I-L-L-I-E-R.
Thank you. Can you tell us about your professional path and what led you to this position?
Well, I have 3 degrees from Northern.
Okay.
And, wow.
Yeah. And one of those is a Native American Studies minor. So I lived in the Chicago suburbs for 17 years and came back to Marquette in the mid-90s and decided that I wanted to finish a degree at Northern that I had started before I left and went to Chicago. So I did that, started finished that first degree, and then did 2 master's degrees after that. And in the course of that, those 2 master's degrees, I was already connected to the center because I had gotten a minor in Native American Studies, and I was there was some shifting of people leaving here and classes opening up with nobody to teach them and whatnot, so I was asked, approached to start teaching a class for the Center for Native Studies, and that was the beginning of this path that I'm on now. So that was 10 years ago.
Okay,
I've
awesome.
Been, teaching for the center now for 10 years.
Okay, what are your favorite classes to teach today? Like, what are some of your favorites?
I am teaching one of my favorites this semester that I've only taught once before. It's First Nations Women.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so that is a 400-level class, and it's in the Gender Studies minor, along with being counting for the Native American Studies minor. So, and I feel very fortunate. This has always been a small class with not very many people in it. And this semester I have 2 Native American men in that class.
Wow.
It's so wonderful to get the male point of view in a women's, gender studies class. And especially when it's a kind of skewed to the Native, which this class is, and to get men's, view on that. And one of them is a 44-year-old older non-traditional student who has children of his own, he is like the perfect person for this class because the women bounce stuff off of him and he tells his opinion. He's older, he has formed opinions, he doesn't feel the pressure of a peer group like young people do, so he just says what he feels.
By First Nation, do you mean like Canadian and
well Greenlandic? We use that term for both down here, because
okay.
We're so close to Canada.
Okay.
In April and I, our director, and other people in this office use that term for Native Americans in the United States along with Canadian people.
Right, because I'm First Nation, so.
What are you, Cree?
No, I am Greenlandic Inuit.
Oh, wow, cool. I've never met an Inuit.
Dual community.
Cool. Wow, that's wonderful. Good for you. We're glad you're here. That's such an unusual, affiliation to have here at Northern. It's great that you're here. Now we get people from all over. It's amazing.
So can you tell us a little bit about the path to getting the major you have now, is received?
Well, that would be a better question for April. That's been a long, convoluted battle to get this, our minor, finally approved as a major. And she's the one who's done most of the work on that. I mean, and it has been very long and involved. And I couldn't even begin to speak to that because I don't know that much about it. It's not my area of expertise or focus of, endeavor.
Okay. What is your motivation, or what was your motivation to start teaching here?
Like, well,
besides the
motivation in general is being Native American, and having experienced racial discrimination as a Native American person. And having had a mother who went to Indian boarding schools and seen the fallout, in my own family of the intergenerational trauma and historic grief of boarding school experience. So, that's a part of it, growing up as a kid, just knowing that things were sort of off in your family, but not really being able to put your finger on exactly why that was or, where that might have come from. And then as an adult, learning, because we don't learn about that, right, in schools
No.
in this country, you don't learn about Indian boarding schools. the Indian boarding school experience in the United States of America, and you don't learn about the residential school experience in Canada. When you go to junior high or high school in this country, they don't teach about that. It's glossed over. It's shoved underneath the carpet because it's not a very, doesn't speak well to the history of the United States of America.
Yeah.
So, I mean, things that are negative about the history of the United States of America, you don't really learn. Students don't really learn.
Yeah.
They don't learn the negative side of our history so much. It's the positive, this and that, that's underlined and concentrated upon and whatnot. So when I finally learned all about the boarding schools in a class here at Northern, you know, that was became something that I thought I need to dedicate at least a part of my life, you know, to teaching other people about this experience. So I created a class here at Northern, History of Indian Boarding School Education, and I teach it every other semester. I've been teaching it every other semester. I'm teaching it now, and April came to me, our director, came to me and asked me if I would be willing to try to teach it again in the winter, if we could get to fill enough to go, and it's already a go. You know, I have enough students, by far, with a cushion, even, of students for that class, so we're going to be teaching that again in the winter. You know, and that's part of my personal mandate, is to inform as many people as possible about the Indian boarding school experience in the United States and the residential school experience in Canada, which when in the United States, boarding school experience was almost 100 years, wasn't a short-lived, you know, flame in the moment, and in residential school in Canada was over 100 years. So these are long, involved Aboriginal experiences, you know, and they created that intergenerational trauma and historic grief, that which is part of the reason why we have so much alcoholism, domestic violence, so many social problems in Indian country stem directly from this boarding school and residential school experience.
This is actually the first time I'm hearing about the boarding school experience.
It doesn't surprise me.
Can you explain further the boarding, like what?
Yeah, it's, you know, I teach a 4-credit class about this, so it's kind of hard to, like, start, you know,
yeah.
I mean, explaining it, because it's very complex. Mm-hmm. You know, it basically was started by, it was one man's idea. Richard Henry Pratt started the Carlisle Indian Boarding School in 1879 in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. It was his original idea. And it was to solve what at time had been discussed for generations, the Indian problem. What are we going to do with these Indians? There's so many of them. They're confined to reservations. They're so expensive. We have to be supporting them all the time now because they can't hunt and gather like they previously had before we overran their country. You know, they're concentrated on reservations. They're living in poverty. You know, what are we going to do about these thousands and thousands of Indians that we're just having to support year upon year upon year with thousands and thousands of dollars, right? So Richard Henry Pratt said, let's educate them. Let's start with the youngest ones and educate them to assimilate them into dominant mainstream culture. So that was the idea, the basis for boarding schools. So he started the first one, and Congress was so impressed with what he accomplished with Carlisle Indian Boarding School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, that they opened up 24 more off-reservation boarding schools across the United States. And by the time that experiment was over with, over 100,000 Indian children have been federally mandated to go to those schools. And it wasn't, you know, they didn't have a choice. You can go to the school or not go to the school. You can go to public school or you can go to this school. No. You went for years and years and years. And people, if the parents didn't want to send their kids, the government sent out representatives, agents, who snatched the kids, you know, literally out of their parents' arms and put them in conveyances, trains, cars, some in Canada, planes, airplanes, and transported them directly to the schools. And many times, many cases, those students didn't go home for years. They did not go home for holidays. They didn't go home in the summertime. Sometimes they didn't go home for 6, 8, 10 years. They were incredibly changed individuals when they finally saw their parents and their grandparents and their families again, dressed differently, hair differently, had lost their indigenous language, were now fluent English speakers. So some of them had grandparents and aunties and uncles who didn't speak English at all, and they could no longer communicate with those people because they were now English speakers, and many of their older relatives didn't speak English at all. So it created this gap, you know, between the younger generation and the older generations that in many cases was never resolved. you know, that the younger generation just went on to be those acculturated, assimilated people, and the older generations were never able to communicate with their younger generation again. So, I mean, that created a lot, and you can imagine the problems. Think about your own family. If that happened in your family, you could no longer talk to your grandparents?
I can't.
Yeah.
I was adopted out.
I mean, and that's another thing. That's another whole subject, adopting out. You know, we were just talking about that in my First Nations women class this morning, about adopting out. That's been a huge problem in Indian country. Indian children being taken out of their parents' arms and adopted out because they're the powers that be, you know, whomever, social workers, didn't feel that their birth parents were taking care of them in the way that they should. And that happened, again, because of the boarding schools and residential schools. They came back from those schools. They felt divorced from their communities. You know, they had suffered sexual abuse, physical abuse, verbal abuse, emotional abuse in these schools. And they were just, like, you know, damaged, terribly emotionally, mentally damaged. So then these people, you know, found a partner, got married, had children, and didn't know how to parent because they hadn't been parented themselves. They'd been taken into that boarding school when they were 6 or 7 or 8 years old and cared for by, you know, dormitory matrons and administrators and teachers who didn't hug them, didn't say, I love you, didn't say, you're a worthwhile human being. You know, so they grew up with self-esteem like this, non-existent. Non-existent. So then these people are trying to raise children, right, and have no clue how to do that. They're impatient, they're yelling and hollering at them, they're doing what they saw and what they experienced in the boarding schools, which is physical violence, emotional violence, verbal violence, sexual violence in their own families. You know, so this happens like generation upon generation upon generation, and is ongoing in Indian country, still follow from that Indian boarding school experience. Ongoing. Still in our communities. So I tell my students in my boarding school class, nobody should wonder why there's so many social problems in Indian country. It all comes from this, basically. Almost all of it. The alcoholism, the drug abuse, the domestic violence, suicide, murder, all of it basically stems from this boarding. None of us have escaped that. There's not an Indian person living today that hasn't had a mother, father, grandma, grandpa, auntie, uncle, you know, somebody in their family that went to boarding school. Yeah, so it's all just filters into our communities still today. That's why we have so many problems.
Do you mind me asking, which tribe do you affiliate yourself with?
I'm Shoshone Sioux Lakota, Burnt Thigh Clan, Rosebud Sioux Reservation. So the government calls us Sioux, S-I-O-U-X. Mm-hmm. That's a government terminology that was on treaties and governmental paperwork. But when we self-identify, we say Lakota. I am Lakota.
Okay, are there any specific stories that you grew up with based on Native American culture
that you would share? Well, my mom used to tell me about stories when she was in boarding school.
Okay.
You know, I have a sad, terrible story that my mom told my sister and I when we were little kids about her boarding school experience, which I spun into a fictional account for one of my thesis inclusions for my Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing. So, yeah, I mean, we have some stories.
Okay. How does the Native American Center for Native American Studies interact with the community here? Like, how did they kind of like just do to raise awareness of just like events and?
Well, we do have events. I mean, it's not just us, the center. So it's usually a combination of different entities, like the Native American Student Association, for example. There's actually 3 Native organizations on this campus. The one that's most active that people hear about the most is the Native American Student Association. So they just had the First Nations Food Taster this past Friday. And we make posters up. Our director does that. She's a great poster producer. And those posters are posted everywhere, in town, all around town, besides all around campus. And we have people who take them out to the local reservations, both Bay Mills and Keweenaw Bay. And so they're everywhere. And community members come to that, native and non-native. Mm-hmm. It's a fundraiser for our powwow. So we, you know, we charge kind of high prices for it, you know, because we feel like it's worth it for the food that people get. I mean, the food is amazing mm-hmm. every year, and we make a lot of money off of that, and that money all is spun into our powwow. So the food tasters are always the first Friday in November, and then our annual Learning to Walk Together traditional powwow is always the weekend closest to St. Patrick's Day in March.
What kind of activities do you do at the powwow?
Well, the normal, you know,
dancing
area for, I mean, powwows are very different regionally. The tribes do different things at powwows regionally. Like where I'm from, they have rodeos associated okay. with powwows. Yeah, they almost always have a rodeo, you know, and the powwow's outdoors, so they have a rodeo grounds and a powwow grounds right next to each other, and so there's a rodeo and a powwow all connected. You know, that's my people, and people out in the West do that. Up here, it's we have Grand Entry, that's the beginning of it, and then there's a lot of intertribal dances. We have a MC who tells what the intertribal dances are, and the intertribals are, the MC will encourage everyone to dance at the intertribals.
Okay.
So students, you know, who don't even have regalia, who are non-native, can get out in the circle and dance at an intertribal. So you just have to listen. You know, to the MC when say, and they'll say to you, you know, loud and proud, this is an intertribal, everybody get out there on this in the circle, you know, so everybody should feel welcome to do that.
Yeah, I'm trying to get her to dance because I'm planning on dancing.
Good.
Powwow.
Good. And you should encourage people. I mean, it's good that you do. Yeah, it's good that you do. So lots of things go on at our powwow, too. We have all kinds of things going on all the time. I mean, there's things going on the sidelines that half the people don't even know about. There's vendors selling things all around. And, you know, for Native people, it's like a community get-together. Old friends that you haven't seen for maybe a year since this last powwow, you know, come to this one and you do too, so you know you're going to see that person there. It's a gathering of community and friends that you maybe haven't seen for months and months or you know, this time last year or whatever. That's how powwows generally are.
Awesome.
How big do these powwows get?
Well, they're ours is little as powwows go. You know, we have on Saturday when we've had a large turnout, we maybe have had 600 people, you know, go in front of our entry desk there. You know, which that to us, that's a huge turnout. The largest powwow in North America is the third week in April every year. It's Gathering of Nations in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And there are tens of thousands of people at Gathering of Nations every year. And Indian people come from all over North America. They come from Alaska and Canada and Mexico, you know, to go to Gathering of Nations. So the grand entry of Gathering of Nations is an amazing thing to see because the regalia is just from everywhere and every kind of regalia you can possibly imagine.
Yeah,
you know, Alaskans wear a lot of fur. You know, so there they are in the Southwest, you know, in the springtime when it's warm out with all this fur on, you know, and, but that's their regalia. Yeah.
My aunt recently purchased a house in Santa Fe, and so she attended it last year, and she had a great time, and she was telling me all these stories about what happened.
Yeah, I have yet to talk to a person who said I had a bad time at Gathering of Nations.
Yeah.
I
don't think that's on my bucket list. I haven't been there yet. Yeah.
I've had one bad experience at a powwow. A person actually told me, they're just like, no, you don't belong here because you're not a real Indian. I'm like,
yeah, well, unfortunately, Indian people say that to Indian people.
Yeah. He was a Cherokee.
Yeah. We have discussions about that here in this office, and we call that crabs in a bucket. You know how crabs climb up over other crabs and pull those crabs down so they'll fall so they can get over the top of them and so they can get, you know, it's like pulling down other people so you can pull yourself up. You know what? Yeah.
Like, I understand because in Nuguitz there's only 800 of us. We're tiny people.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, I understand. Like,
There's plenty of tribes here in this, you know, in the United States, too, that are tiny little tribes, especially on the eastern seaboard, you know, where they were so decimated in numbers on the eastern seaboard. Mm-hmm. And even in the southeast, a lot of tribes that are very, very small. Very few federally recognized tribes on the eastern seaboard and in the southeastern United States. Most of those 567 federally recognized Indian tribes are all in the Midwest and in the western states, and in Alaska. There's 200 and some just in Alaska. Mm. Alaska is an amazing place for Indian people.
What are some of the obstacles that the Center for Native American Studies has gone through trying to acquire the major?
Again, that's an April question.
Okay.
Yeah, that's just not my focus of expertise and not something I'm, you know, we all depend on her, our director, our leader, you know, to be taking care of this, and she has been taking care of it, you know, ongoing as we've worked toward that major for years and years. It seems like, you know, from my perspective, a large part of it has been NMU administration.
Okay.
You know, just saying it's not, the time's not right. You know, the time's not right. We need to wait, you know, and you need to be stronger as an entity here. You know, the time's not right. Seems like that's been over and over and over again. So, and why they decided to do this at this particular time, when so much else seems to be going in the toilet around here in general on Northern's campus, I don't really understand it, but...
Anything? Is there anything that you would like to add or like to leave out of the recording?
No, not really. So what are you going to do with this? What's the project?
The project is we're going to submit it to the archives for later use of just to go back and have it as a resource for future
generations
and projects. Is kind of like
okay. So are you working with Marcus Robbins and the group over in NMU Archives?
No, we're not.
No, we are submitting this back to Catherine.
Catherine, yeah.
Okay. And then she's gonna hand it off from there.
I wonder if she's gonna compile everybody's work, all their interviews, so that's like they play like one long interview or like one interview right after another.
Not too sure. All I know is that we're going to have it scribed out, and it's going to be submitted to the library as well.
Okay. So, yeah. Interesting. Cool. All right. Well, good for you. Maybe you want to leave out that toilet part.
Well, is that it? Okay, we're going to end the recording now.